Good morning, may it please the court. My name's Timothy Walker, registration number 5351. I represent the appellant, Margaret Radmeier, in this case, and I would respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel, it's up for you to watch your time. And speaking of time, I think we need to start the clock.
Thank you. I would, if it pleases the court, I would like to provide the court with a timeline of this case, because the court clearly, I would think, wonders why in the world is this case, which was decided in 2007, why has it languished for 7 years? And only now are we in front of this honorable court providing oral arguments.
We understand that there was a bankruptcy stay.
Well, there was more than that, Your Honor. If I might, we have contested permanent orders heard September 22nd, 2006. Written findings of fact and conclusions were submitted January 8th of 2007. Now, in those orders, the decree of dissolution was deferred until green cards were issued, because these folks were residents of South Africa. They were not citizens of the United States. The issue of attorney's fees was bifurcated and postponed to a later hearing. So for purposes of appeal, these permanent orders were not final at that time. Green cards were issued and a decree of dissolution was entered on November 17, 2008, but the record will reflect that it was originally entered on August 14, 2007, and because of the immigration problems, I had to seek a CAR 21 order from the Supreme Court of Colorado, and I got it, and the decree was rendered, the original decree was rendered void ab initio, which is why the decree was then re-entered on November 17th after the green cards were issued. There was a contested hearing on attorney's fees in the spring of 2009, a written order on attorney's fees July 20th of 2009, and then, and by the way, as a result of the property division in the permanent orders, the wife was awarded the marital home, which had an equity value of about $518,000, but she was ordered to execute a promissory note to the husband for $200,000, which was due in May of 2008. That would be 17 months later, so she only had 17 months to live in the marital home, and I'll get to that in a moment. The reason that's part of the timeline is that on October 31st, 2009, the husband filed a Rule 120 motion to sell the marital home, to foreclose on his promissory note. That was in Jefferson County case 09CV5219. Then the wife filed her timely notice of appeal on July 31st, 2009, because the orders were final. Record was due on December 3rd, 2009. February 23rd, 2010, the wife was required to file a bankruptcy. She filed first a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which was converted to a Chapter 13 bankruptcy on March 22nd, 2010. And Your Honor is correct, that's the main reason why this case was delayed, because the automatic stay from the bankruptcy court stayed all proceedings on its appeal. We were asked to file timely reports to the Court of Appeal, which we did, of the progress of the case. May 26, 2011, the marital residence was sold pursuant to the 120 action, the Rule 120 action. The bankruptcy was discharged or terminated on July 11, 2013. So now the case is ready to be briefed before this honorable court. The wife obtained 3 enlargements of time from this court within its discretion to file the opening brief, and then suddenly the wife discovered that the record on appeal, which she had designated, was not complete. The trial court informed the wife that they had just found 5 files that were never submitted to this court. So the wife filed on her behalf a motion asking to supplement the record. And on the 10th of December, 2013, that was denied without comment by this court. So, based on that timeline, this honorable court is hearing an appeal with an incomplete record, I believe through no fault of counsel, and there are pertinent portions of that record, those five files, relative to the health of the parties and the health of my client, that the court simply doesn't have. So, with that, I would summarize what I'm going to do in my oral arguments by simply saying that we believe that the trial court abused its discretion in limiting maintenance to 8 years without proper findings. We believe that the trial court abused its discretion in imputing income to the wife. And we believe the trial court abused its discretion in its property division award. Let me take the first issue. We believe, and I'm going to take them a little bit out of order because I think the implication of income issue is secondary to the our argument that the court, we believe, abused its discretion in limiting the amount of maintenance to 8 years in this case. I believe this honorable court is well aware that one of the children of the parties, who's now 26 or 27, was severely disabled, Asperger's disease and a number of disorders. The party stipulated that he was disabled so that for purposes of child support would continue beyond the age of 19. But there's record support that as a result of his disability, the wife was required to care for this child 24/7. And the trial court, in its findings, limited her maintenance to a time period of 8 years. Where it got the 8 years, I don't know, Your Honor. There was no evidence in the record to support the trial court's conclusion that the wife's ability to earn income should improve in the future. There were no findings as to the improvement of her condition, her health condition, or an improvement in Tim, the minor child's, or the now the older child's condition. And as part of his property division award, the wife didn't receive any liquid assets. She received just the marital home and covered by a $200,000 note back to the husband.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr.
Yes,
Walker.
Sir.
My understanding is that the trial court made a credibility finding about wife.
That's correct.
Would you please explain how that plays into your argument?
Well, obviously we disagree with the court's credibility finding, but I know that the court clearly had discretion to rule on credibility and that finding won't be disturbed unless there's a clear abuse of discretion. I understand that. But I believe, and I wasn't there at the trial, I think this court knows
I know.
It. So I can't really respond as to the demeanor of the witnesses or exactly what prompted the judge to make his credibility ruling.
But isn't that sort of a thread that weaves through all these findings by the trial court that you're talking about?
I think it is possibly one of many threads. That's correct.
Okay.
Now, there was record support, by the way, of the wife's health condition, interstitial cystitis and other diseases. And it seems that under Antuna, the case cited by the trial court, that the trial court should have made certain findings. In Antuna, the court said, while the purpose of maintenance is not to ensure that the parties have an equal lifestyle forever, the court must consider the reasonable needs of a spouse which depend on the particular facts and circumstances of the party's marriage. And in this case, there were particular facts and circumstances of the Rademeyer marriage, namely the child, Timothy, and the need for his 24/7 care by the mother. But then Antuna goes on to say, the court should also state the reasons upon which it bases the duration of its award. The reason I found that the trial court gave was that it hoped the wife's income earning ability would improve in the future. And I did not, didn't see that was sufficient. I see I have a yellow light, so I'm going to have to move on.
You've got about 4 minutes and 50 seconds.
Thank you. I see that. Thank you.
Counsel, with regard to, your challenge to the 8 years of maintenance, wasn't there some information in the record upon which the trial could have reasonably relied upon that she was seeking retraining? In fact, wasn't she, didn't she present some information about the cost of that retraining?
She testified that she wanted to go back to college, but of course, I'm not sure whether that was part of the trial court's credibility issue with her or not, because she didn't present really hard evidence on what she wanted to do, as I reviewed the record.
But assuming that the trial court gave some credence to that information about seeking retraining, why wouldn't 8 years be a reasonable amount of time in which for her to get retraining or begin some sort of...
Because there was record evidence, Your Honor, that she had to care for this child, an adult child, 24/7, and how could she get any training if she has to care for the child?
Mr. Walker, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Wasn't that one of the issues that the court ultimately resolved against wife by saying she was seeking the retraining and wanted to go back to school, so she even anticipated that she would have time out of the home where she wasn't caring for the child? And husband had testified that 24/7 care wasn't necessary and that the child was out of the home for a certain amount of hours. So ultimately, the trial court heard those concerns but resolved them against wife.
Well, and Your Honor, with all due respect, here's where the missing files of the record become so important, because there was evidence in those files presented to the trial court about the need for this child to be cared for 24/7, and there wasn't evidence, it's reported CFI, for example, there wasn't any evidence that showed that this child's condition was going to improve.
Okay, well, let's even assume that all of that was in the record. The trial court was aware of that, right?
It should have
and
been.
And ultimately resolved the factual issue by saying that there was time that did not require 24/7 care by wife with which she could be employed and have time out of the home to either pursue her retraining or whatever she chose to, right?
Yes. I'd like to continue with the argument briefly with respect to the Martinez case. I think Martinez is very helpful to this court when it comes to the imputation of income. Number one, if the court notes the imputation by trial court of income to the wife was contained in its finding number 13, and that finding was entitled the economic circumstances of the parties. It was part of the property division concerns of the court, not any concern with respect to child support. Yet the trial court used that finding to impute income to the wife, and there was no record support that we could find, that I could find, to support that, and certainly no record support in the child support area, except the judge simply bootstrapped his imputation of income that he had made in the economic circumstances consideration into the child support. Now, Martinez is a very instructive case on this point, I believe, because in that case, the court said, we conclude, and this was interpreting the child support statute dealing with imputation of income, and it said, we conclude that the General Assembly intended income imputation to be an important exception to the normal rule of computation based on actual gross income of the parent. The legislature meant this exception to prevent detriment to children by deterring parents from making employment choices that cannot account for their children's welfare. Now, Mrs. Rademeyer made an employment choice for her child's welfare to care for him. Nevertheless, going on with Martinez, the court said the General Assembly intended courts to approach income imputation with caution. Legislative history aids in this construction of the statute. And finally, in Martinez, the court said the intent of income imputation, when read as a whole and viewed in the light of the legislative history, is to impute income when the parent shirks his or her child support obligation by unreasonably foregoing higher paying or employment, in that case, that he or she could obtain. There was no finding by the trial court that Mrs. Rademeyer, by caring for him, was shirking her obligation to him. Nothing in the record that we could find. I see that my time is up, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Epstein, attorney registration 14987, preferred Wedgel Epstein. At me at council table is Peter Krumholz with Hale Westfall. Thank you, Mr. Walker. Your Honors, the best iteration of the standard this court is to apply is set forth in E-470 Public Highway Authority versus Revenig, 140 Pacific 3rd, 227, Colorado App, 2006. And I'd like to read very briefly from that decision. A trial court abuses its discretion if its ruling is manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. In assessing whether a trial court's decision is manifestly unreasonable, arbitrary, or unfair, we ask not whether we, i.e. the appellate court, would have reached a different result, but rather whether the trial court's decision fell within a range of reasonable options. Your Honor, the trial court's rulings in every respect fell within reasonable options. The findings were highly detailed with great specificity to evidence before the trial court. There's an adage, when you don't have law, argue facts. Apparently in this case, not only are facts being argued, but facts not of the record that this court can be considered are being argued. Your Honor, Mr. Walker's wrong on the title. This case was initially started in 2002, and I've been on for the duration. It was ultimately dismissed, and a second divorce case was filed in 2004. We are now 10 years later, and Mrs. Rademeyer apparently is arguing that that's relevant. Your Honor, divorce is difficult. And this divorce was difficult because of the immigration issues. And it was made more difficult by Ms. Rademeyer's decisions. Ms. Rademeyer's counsel is coming here today essentially arguing that the court got the facts wrong and that Ms. Rademeyer has got the short end of the stick. The court has read the ruling, highly detailed ruling from Judge Weir. Judge Weir is giving wife approximately 60% of the marital estate. I'm unaware of any case in this case or other jurisdictions where a judge who gave a party 60% of the estate is later found to have been abusive of its discretion, and to award them more.
Counsel, can you address your opponent's contention that the son's disability warranted a different amount or a different time for maintenance and didn't warrant an imputation of income to the mother?
Okay.
I disagree with the factual recitation of Tim's condition. The court will recall that a brief was filed where Ms. Rademeyer argued all these conditions relative to Tim's son, which occurred after the close of the record. The record we have supports the court's finding and the detail in all of it. There are detailed findings of paragraph 13 on page 3 relative to Tim's being in school for 6 hours a day. And the whole paradigm for mom working here was based on mom at least trying to work at home at 12:50 an hour for 20 to 25 a week. That is not an outrageous imputation. But the court specifically found in paragraph 13 that Tim, based on all the credibility, all the evidence before it, that while Tim has profound deficits, it does not prohibit mother from working at least part-time. It's supported on the record. Now, one other thing Judge Weir said is that we're going to give her the house because she's got these kids there, but we're not real certain that it's a wise decision for the wife to keep the house. It's a 6,000 square foot house, and there was a ton of equity in it. The wife, instead of selling the house in a commercially reasonable fashion, filed appeals, filed reconsideration, filed bankruptcy. Judge Weir specifically gave Mr. Rademeyer the right to foreclose if wife did not sell the house or otherwise pay husband off within a certain period of time. I think that's very fair. Now, with respect to the imputation of income, the statute is very clear that if a party is voluntarily unemployed, the court can impute income. The evidence was undisputed. Mom was unemployed. Mom had no intention of ever going to work. And I think that struck the court out. Meanwhile, Judge Weir also noted very specifically and said, I believe in paragraph 15, he specifically says neither party has issues with respect to physical or mental health. Accordingly, this is a case of voluntary unemployment. The court was within its right to impute income, and the imputation was very, very moderate. We're not saying she can go out and get even $30,000 or $40,000 a year. We're saying it's about $1,300 a month, which is reasonable to expect a healthy person to be able to work. Now, with respect to the imputation issue, the Martinez case is an outlier. Martinez had a problem with marijuana. He had a job, I want to say $45,000 a year. He failed the test and he got fired. The trial court initially assessed father's income, imputed income, at the highest level he ever made, even though because he got fired for smoking pot, he got a lesser paying job. The Court of Appeals, and again, there's no case like this that I'm aware of, and it's really not binding on this court, said, well, his smoking marijuana is a disease. Therefore, if he's powerless over his disease, his loss of employment may not have been voluntary, it may have been involuntary. That case has no dispositive effect here. Furthermore, it was an issue of voluntary underemployment, not an absolute refusal to work at all. Very briefly about the record, Your Honor. Under Colorado Appellate Rule 10, if you take a look at C and E, if there's a problem with the record, then the obligation rests on the person asserting the appeal to make an effort to recreate the record. Mr. Walker's side of the case has failed to do this. I learned this the hard way. It's in the cases in the marriage of McSued, M-C-S-O-U-D, which stands for that proposition that a party can't complain about a lack of a record when they waive their right to try to create the record. Judge Bernard picked up on the issue of credibility. I was at the trial. I believe that Judge Weir set forth the reasons, his basis, for not believing what Mother was saying. He specifically said, she's covering expenses. And in that one instance, she's carrying an expense of $614 a month for school with absolutely no intention of going to school. And of course, the irony there is, how is she going to go to school if she has to be with this one child 24/7? Let's talk about for a moment, and I welcome questions. I don't know if I can talk about 15 minutes on this case, because I think it's relatively narrow. The maintenance was for a period of 8 years on a 24-year marriage. That's about a third of the time. The new maintenance guidelines suggest that maintenance be available for approximately half the time of a marriage.
Do you concede they don't apply here, though?
Oh, they absolutely don't apply, but it reflects a public policy. How can Judge Weir, who's given Mom 35% of the marriage, be that far off 50? How can it be unreasonable? How can it be, just to quote, E-470, how can it be outside of the range of reasonable options? Furthermore, you know, this court should be very reluctant and cautious about overturning credibility decisions. Sometimes that happens to work justice. But Mother has options here. Tim, the son, was stipulated to be incapacitated, minor for purposes of child support. Dad has always admitted that. Mother is free to go back on and modify. If this boy needs new programs, if there's a halfway house, Mother can go back and seek from Father, who doesn't make a nice living, additional monies for Tim. Furthermore, Mother has the option of modifying maintenance. When the court issues a maintenance award, it cannot be contractual. While the court set a term of years, the court always retains jurisdiction to modify the maintenance based on a change in circumstances. Well, that's where Mother's remedy should be, and not in this court. And Mr. Walker, if he files the motion to modify, will know what to plead. At the time of the permanent orders, at paragraph 15, Judge Weir said Mom has no physical or mental problems that would prevent her from being employed. Well, then what Mrs. Rademeyer does is she goes to the trial court and says, okay, I was in good health then. Now I've got this medical report indicating those are my ailments. That's a continuing and substantial ongoing change of circumstances, so as to get in the door on a modification hearing. I think the attorney's fees sought at this level is absolutely inappropriate. 39.5 of the appellate rules permit the court to consider fees or to remand. However, fees under either 13, 17, 101, the Federal Grounds Statute, of 1410.119, which is the fee statute in the Family Law Code, permit a request for fees. However, this court has no evidence before it as to what the fees are, what an appropriate level of fees should be, Mr. Radebeiner's ability to pay, the reasonableness and necessity. Because the mother's real remedy rests in modification at the trial level, mother can also seek a prospective award of attorney's fees under 1410.119 and in re the marriage of Rose, and I'm sorry I do not have the cite for this court. And believe me, Your Honors, if an attorney's fees hearing comes back up in the trial court, there will be a full opportunity for Ms. Radebeiner to explore that issue. Your Honor, in one of the briefs, I think it was the one where facts were alleged, and I don't want to address that too much. Facts were alleged, which occurred after the close of the evidence in the record. I believe Ms. Radebeiner said she has nothing left. Well, Your Honor, she had an asset worth $318,000. First of all, we don't believe she's got nothing left. And second of all, it's not a cognizant fact before this court, to my knowledge. Your Honor, with respect to the amount of maintenance, I've got 15 seconds. Judge Weir relied upon mom's financial statements and dad's testimony as to reasonable needs. He specifically found it to be puffed up. Currently, mom's package is approximately $5,400 a month. As noted in mom's bankruptcy filing, which is court potential judicial notice, she said her expenses were $5,430, and she's getting $5,390 a month or something like that. Your Honors, I see that my time is up. I appreciate the time you've given me this morning, and if you want to ask any questions, I'd be more than happy to respond.
We're good, Mr. Epstein.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Safe journey home.